they do stay up, whether parents want them to go to bed or not. And they're not fully functioning their brains in the morning.
No student would start school before 8 a.m. under a proposal in Anchorage to change school start times. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 9th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a new power plant is to be built in Togiak.
And these are the big generators that'll be powering the village and keeping the lights on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
As Alaska's primary elections get closer, there are a handful of contests that will likely be decided in August, far ahead of the November general election. There's a vigorous fight for control of the state house playing out in a handful of districts. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, candidates in the state's most liberal corner are trying to convince voters they're the most progressive choice in a solidly Democratic district.
District 20 is what you might call Anchorage's historic area, encompassing downtown, Ship Creek, and the surrounding neighborhoods. For a decade and a half, it's been represented by Democrat Les Guerra, who decided not to seek another term. The race to replace him has gotten highly competitive, flooded with tens of thousands of dollars ahead of the primary and campaign signs on what seems like every other lawn. Guerra's chosen successor is union organizer and former Alaska Democratic Party communications director Zach Fields.
I've worked both in activism and in the government, and I think that combination of having an insider's view of public policy, but also an activist ethos of always pushing for positive change is a good combination for this district.
An Alaskan for 6 years, Fields has racked up the most high-profile endorsements from established Democrats, and as of late July, raised almost $35,000 from hundreds of individual donors and union groups. Fields' platform is focused on environmental conservation, increased spending on education, law enforcement, and infrastructure. To pay for those things, he wants to increase taxes.
In order of preference, I support higher taxes on oil production. I also support a progressively structured income tax, and I would consider supporting a sales tax if it had protections against regressivity to make sure it doesn't fall hard on working families.
While a push for more taxes would be a deal breaker in many conservative-leaning parts of Anchorage, in the District 20 primary, it's relatively uncontroversial. The area is so packed with registered Democrats that the primary is all but certain to determine who will represent the district, and that has candidates competing to establish their progressive bona fides to voters. Former prosecutor and avowed policy wonk Cliff Grow is making that case through his decades of experience working on state economic policy.
I am by far the most knowledgeable candidate about our fiscal situation in this race.
Grow was born in the district and is a product of Anchorage Public Schools. As a legislative staffer in the 80s, he helped write the bill establishing the permanent fund dividend. And for the last 4 years, Grow has traveled the state trying to get residents engaged with the dire budget situation caused by the oil price decline. He, too, wants a legislature that boosts funding for criminal prosecutors, state troopers, and education paid for by restoring the income tax the state had in place until 1980.
The days of big, easy oil money are over for Alaska, and Alaska needs to have the maturity to understand that our state needs to have more traditional and conventional ways of financing public services.
Grow has the most detailed policy proposals of all three candidates, ranging from healthcare price transparency to suggestions for tax credits that might boost economic development. Though Grow's campaign has technically raised the most money, the majority of it, more than $47,000, was self-financed. Candidate Elias Rojas has also put several thousand dollars of his own money into his campaign. The business owner and community organizer has a significant number of individual donations from out of state as well, something he attributes to his professional background working in California and New York prior to moving to Alaska almost 12 years ago.
Top of mind to most folks is really trying to figure out how to implement a comprehensive fiscal plan, and at the same time trying to make sure that our priorities are addressed in that fiscal plan. Things like reducing crime, making sure our schools are good schools, and we have a strong university system.
Rojas hesitates to give details about specific components of a fiscal plan, saying it'll require compromise from everyone involved. Rojas has endorsements from a lot of local Anchorage politicians and community activists, including several sitting assembly members. He says he's built a strong network in the city through his past efforts pushing forward equal rights measures in Anchorage, something he'd continue pursuing through a statewide anti-discrimination policy.
You know, I have the ability to coalition build when I get to Juneau, and I've had that experience, you know, working on LGBT issues. I've needed to work across the aisle and feel that that's a strength that I have that Juneau needs right now.
The winner of the August 21st Democratic primary will appear on the November ballot against Republican Caesar Martinson. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Utility companies will soon be able to loan customers money for energy efficiency upgrades and renewable energy systems by tacking on a charge to their monthly utility bill. It's a form of lending called on-bill financing that has been used elsewhere in the country and was made possible in Alaska by a bill signed into law by Governor Walker last month. The utility loans could cover a range of upgrades, including solar panels, higher efficiency appliances, and switches in heating fuel systems. Corey Borgeson is president and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association in Fairbanks.
We think it's a good tool to have, and we certainly will look at using it.
Borgeson testified before the state legislature in favor of the bill. While he says Golden Valley doesn't currently have plans to implement a loan program right away, they will consider it in the future.
It kind of requires Golden Valley to set up a banking business. We have to make loans, we have to charge interest rates, we have to process payments. What happens when someone doesn't pay?
The bill gives utility companies the power to suspend service to a customer if they fail to pay back their loan. Representative Adam Wool, a Democrat from Fairbanks and one of the bill's sponsors, said in a press release that the new legislation is vitally important for the Interior Energy Project. That project's goal is to expand access to natural gas in the interior. Wool said it could be used to help Fairbanks area homeowners convert from heating oil to natural gas, which will be a key component of the project's success. The Interior Gas Utility, which would provide the natural gas, says it is evaluating all options to help residents with conversion, including a possible loan program. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan visited several communities last week in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to listen to the top concerns from residents. Those topics included jobs, the proposed Donlin mine, and erosion. KYUK's Christy Schallenberger has the details.
Republican U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan was hosted in 11 villages in 4 days last week.
I was joking with my staff yesterday that I probably put on 5 to 10 pounds because of all the great salmon that I ate.
He listened as residents asked him about jobs, discussed their concerns about the proposed Donlin mine, and about erosion. How to prepare for and respond to erosion is one of the biggest problems facing many communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, like Nutok and Apakiak and Chafornik. Chafornik is one of the villages that Sullivan visited. It sits near the coast.
It was a concern because those houses are really close to the shore.
Bernadette Lewis is the executive director for the Chafornik Traditional Council. She says some of the houses sit about 10 feet from some bodies of water, and it's expensive to move them.
That we don't have funding to buy them new homes if we are going to move the homes away from the shore.
Sullivan says that the main problem is getting funding that is already available delivered to those communities who need it. He says funding increased for the Denali Commission, a federal agency that is helping some communities move. But he says the best solutions will come from community members.
One of the ideas, as I mentioned, was, well, let's look at ways that we can, you know, in some ways build our own houses with our own materials.
The YK Delta is also one of Alaska's most impoverished regions, and that makes job growth a top concern among residents. Again, Sullivan points to community innovation as the best solution. One industry that could spur job growth is mining. The proposed Donlin gold mine, which would be one of the biggest in the world if completed, promises more than 3,000 jobs at the height of its construction, and 1,000 jobs annually. Sullivan wouldn't say outright whether or not he supports the mine, But he does say the permitting process could be streamlined.
You know, they have to meet a very high standard. The standard is they can't impact the natural resource that we already know is out there, which is the abundant fish. But they also, it's incumbent upon the federal government to move that along.
And he says there were concerns about the route of the proposed gas line that would provide the fuel to power the mine's operations. Donlin Gold, the company developing the mine, plans to build a 315-mile pipeline from Cook Inlet across the Alaska Range to the site. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Christy Schallenberger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a seabird die-off in the Chukchi and Bering Seas has biologists concerned.
These birds have been starving. They've usually appeared to have died from starvation. They're very emaciated.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
After about a year of discussion and a consultant study, Anchorage School District Superintendent Dr. Dina Bishop has proposed later start times for high school and junior high students. Bishop's proposal would also have elementary school students starting slightly earlier. The biggest change would be for junior high students, who, under the proposal, would start school at 9:30, more than an hour later than currently. Bishop has proposed an 8 a.m. start time for high school, that's a half hour later, and 8:45 for elementary students, which would be 15 minutes earlier. Dr. Bishop joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So why? That's my main question. Why do we want to change start times at all? Why do we need this?
Sure. So our biggest why in the district is that we want kids to do well and we want them to be successful. We want to do what's best for kids and their learning. So the specifics, really, over the last 10 years, the different stakeholders have been approaching the board and providing information about brain research, all the like about secondary students. They're pretty nocturnal. Their brains, they do stay up whether parents want them to go to bed or not. And they're not fully functioning their brains in the morning. But most recently, about 18 months ago, West High students started a petition, and over 5,000 people within the school, internally to the district as well as externally, asked the board to look into this, knowing that school start times really aren't just a school thing, if you will. Our parents' work schedules, babysitting schedules, sports schedules, doctor's appointments, everything operates around, if you have children, and one-fifth of our community does have someone in a school, we would have to consider that. So we spent a year getting information, having community meetings and the like, to finally have that recommendation that the board asked for.
It seems like more sleep would be better, but when people argue against this, what is their argument?
The biggest argument is really the interruption to family. If I have a family schedule and it's working for me, then it disrupts when I have younger children or students in two different schools with my work. So that's the primary. A lot of the comments are, you know what, I have to get up early. The world doesn't wait for kids. Just make them get up, make them go to sleep earlier. But what we know about, you know, the frontal cortex of the brain and lots of other things, that kids don't just go to sleep. And knowing that they're awake past 10 o'clock, the majority of them, and to get up to be in school by 7:30, they wouldn't be getting that 8 hours. But really the change is the biggest issue, not necessarily that it's at one time or another. It's not that I don't want high school at this time or elementary. It literally was the impact on daily schedules.
What happens next? I guess there are some community meetings for public comment. It sounds like the board would vote in October, maybe at the earliest. So what's the earliest that this could actually be implemented?
We are looking for the fall of 19. So we have a whole year out. And that was important for our board as well, to ensure that arrangements and discussions, work schedules, daycares. The market will follow where people are. So we know that that has changed, and we've studied that in other communities. So we're confident, but we want time for people to talk, to plan, to understand. And ultimately, there hasn't really been anyone that says, you know what, I don't understand the research or I don't believe the research. It's really been about how this impacts me personally. My life is already busy as can be and stressors, and this is going to add one more. And therefore, the time we thought it was quite important.
Dr. Dina Bishop is superintendent of the Anchorage School District. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Processing salmon and other business comes to a standstill in Togiak as regular blackouts hit the small village. The community's grid can't sustain the required amount of power to support its needs, but there is a solution on the horizon, KDLG's Austin Fast reports.
Unfortunately, it's not rare for the lights to go out in Togiak, but that could all change in September when a new power plant should be up and running. Electrician Joel Elson gives me a look around the spotless new building.
We're stepping into Gen Bay 2 right now, and these are the big generators that'll be powering the village and keeping the lights on. They're brand new, beautiful Cat engines, and they're just top of the line. They've really done a great job putting them together here.
The Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC, is a nonprofit electric utility providing power to 58 communities, including Togiak. Constructing the new plant comes at a cost of $14.8 million, most of which comes from the federally funded Denali Commission. AVEC and Togiak Natives Limited each kicked in a portion of funding as well. Project manager Joe Ursley says the old plant and rusting tank farm just can't keep up with the village's needs any longer.
It's like trying to go up a hill in your car in too high a gear. There's too much load and your car can't chug up the hill.
Togiak is home to two seafood processors. These regular blackouts completely halt production, so fishermen and processors are excited for the new plant. Copper River Seafood's manager Michael Gilbert is managing to process the catch from this summer's record-breaking sockeye run, but it isn't easy.
It's a every 2 or 3 day thing that power goes down, and we got freezers going and machines running, and kind of puts a damper on things, if you know what I mean. It's a task to get freezers to cycle back up again, ice machines. You know, it takes a good hour to get back on track.
Even though the loss of power is frustrating, the situation could be worse. Fisherman Martha Fox remembers years ago when power went out for days instead of hours.
And it was when it was cold. And people here don't have fire, you know, wood and the water pipes freeze, some houses, and then they're stuck without water for the rest of, you know, until it thaws out.
Back at the plant, Ursley says the four new diesel generators and new fuel tanks will be more reliable and reduce the risk of leaking contaminants into Togiak's soil and groundwater. He says everything should be up and running by mid-September. The new tank farm increases fuel capacity to 630,000 gallons of diesel, meaning they can bring down costs by barging it in less often. That's in addition to cost savings from the top-of-the-line generators workers are now putting the finishing touches on. Ursley says the rusted old equipment will be cleaned up and hauled off to a safe disposal site near Togiak. Going forward, the Alaska Energy Authority plans to install a transmission line from Togiak's new plant to neighboring Twin Hills to provide reliable energy by the end of 2019. Twin Hills currently operates its own electric utility and will turn operation over to AVEC once that project is completed. In Togiak, I'm Austin Fast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message is sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Since May, hundreds of dead and dying seabirds have been found across the northern Bering and southern Chukchi Seas. The National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have labeled the event a die-off and are coordinating efforts within local communities. Dr. Kathy Kulitz is a wildlife biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
These birds have been starving. They've usually appear to have died from starvation. They're very emaciated. Their muscles have atrophied. There's a lot of physical signs inside the body indicating they've been starving.
So far, there has been no evidence of disease or toxins in the seabirds. But coastal communities on St. Lawrence Island near Nome and in Shishmaref have all found dead birds, including murres, fulmars, shearwaters, kittiwakes, auklets, and puffins washing up on shore. Kulitz says most of the carcasses were found in June but have continued through the summer. This die-off is unusual because of the duration and large geographic area. Since the spring, seabird die-offs have also been recorded in the Pribilof Islands and the northern Gulf of Alaska. Kulitz says it's concerning from an ecological standpoint and because the birds are a food source.
People that live in these remote communities, they rely on birds for eggs or for the meat, and they have noticed that the birds weren't coming to the colony, or they were finding sick birds acting odd.
This die-off is separate from an event that began in 2015 and killed an estimated 500,000 common murres in Alaska. Researchers hypothesize it could be connected to an ocean temperature phenomenon called the blob, like that die-off was. Although at this point, Kulitz says scientists haven't proven that link. If you see dead or dying birds, you can report the sighting to the USFWS at 1-866-527-3358. Severe sport fishing restrictions this summer in Southeast forced the cancellation of Wrangell's King Salmon Derby this year, and now the town is kicking off its Silver Salmon Derby. That's this weekend, and as KSTK's June Leffler reports, the stakes are high for the Silver Salmon Derby to bring in enough money and enthusiasm to keep the event going.
For 65 years, Wrangell has held the longest King Derby in Southeast Alaska, lasting a whole month. This is the first year the town canceled the event, when the Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed sport fishing around the entirety of the island until mid-June. Derby organizers are anxious, wondering if the Silver Salmon Derby can garner interest like a King Derby would. The best measure of that will be in ticket sales.
We need to sell as many tickets as we can, obviously, and have this thing work so we can justify having another one next year.
Sean Curley is the Derby chairman. He's looking to sell 300 tickets minimum. The last Coho Derby was held in 1996 and sold an abysmal 50 tickets, a bad sign for this year's Derby organizers. But the Coho Derby was held alongside the King Derby in the past. This year, it's the only fishing competition in town. And the prize money is way more. In 1996, first place received $250. This year, first place will get $2,000.
We might have went overboard, but we're hoping to sell enough tickets to just break even and offer up a community event here that's fun for, you know, your family and your visiting friends, and also just to have a local friendly competition.
A competition that may have to take over for the King Derby if low Chinook forecasts persist.
It's looking like we might not have a King Salmon Derby again next year.
This year's Derby tickets will be reduced from $35 to $20. The Chamber of Commerce will award weekly $250 cash prizes with a $500 prize for Labor Day weekend. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Last weekend, Sitka had its very first drag show. Although it was a bit of a risk, the producers and performers believe the show was a huge hit and a welcome success for Sitka's queer community. Two headliners, both professional drag queens, traveled from Juneau and Tacoma to support the local cast. KCAW's Rachel Cassandra has more.
The first floor of the Mean Queen restaurant is sold out. About 120, mostly female audience members, scream and cheer. Some hold dollars up in the air to tip Lola Monet, a drag queen from Juneau. Monet wears a low-cut black dress, pearls, and hip pads to fill out her curves. Like many drag performers, she prefers female pronouns when in her drag persona. The Sitka show is only her fourth performance.
So I'm a baby drag queen, sorry.
Monet has always been drawn to drag.
I've loved dress up ever since I was a little kid. It's dress up, it's playtime. After I started like playing with the ladies' clothes, I was never allowed to play dress up again. So I love doing drag. It allows me to express the feminine side of me just a little bit.
For Ann Poindexter, the other headliner, drag has also allowed them to play with gender in a way they weren't allowed growing up. Poindexter uses the pronouns they and them. They grew up Mormon in Utah.
I was raised to believe that being queer is, you know, an abomination and that it would mean eternal damnation and sadness for me.
Poindexter has a thick beard and fake eyelashes, neutral lipstick, and a tan dress. In Poindexter's adult life, gender identity has become incredibly important to them.
And especially that space between what is traditionally defined as masculine and feminine, that is where I feel the most comfortable and at home.
Poindexter is fortunate. Their family has overcome religious barriers and grown to accept and embrace Poindexter's gender expressions. The show wasn't only a space for the experienced headliners, though. A number of local performers experimented with drag for the first time. That includes Greg, aka Bailey Craig, the MC of the event.
I am wearing a hideous auburn wig. It's absolutely terrible. And I'm wearing a fake mustache and cargo shorts and a cream-colored polo with red and green stripes and Birkenstocks and socks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like, you know, essentially the typical white dad. It is so far from who I am as a woman and how I identify as a woman.
The creators were overwhelmed with the rush of support from the community. The show sold out in 36 hours, without even a formal event announcement. Here's Aaron Bastola, a lifetime resident who enjoyed the show as an audience member.
It's really kind of comforting and reassuring to see people coming out, both like not just to enjoy a show, but also like in support of that.
These kinds of spaces have the potential to create a more queer-friendly Sitka. That includes a culture with space for kids growing up queer and questioning. Reporting from Sitka, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, Austin Fast in Togiak, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, June Leffler in Wrangell, and Rachel Cassandra in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.